Institute, and he was its secretary for 10 years. He has been a director for 40 years, and your editor for all of those 40 years, but the one he took off to be president. The other participant is also a past president of the Institute. He was vice president for 4 years and manager for 16 years. He has been a director off and on for 13 years. The list of committee memberships and committee chairmanships that these gentlemen have held is well nigh endless, and the service that they have rendered the Institute is incalculable. Gentlemen, I give you and salute Dr. Alfred N. Goldsmith and Mr. John V. L. Hogan.
Well, Alfred, I think if we pull this down a little bit. Oh, wonderful. Takes an engineer.
Makes an editor.
Well, you know, we picked the wrong title for this paper. It should have been From Two Acorns to an Oak. And I thought maybe you'd start the ball rolling by apologizing for having created a title that implied only one acorn.
Well, fortunately, we have a clearly sympathetic audience because, as you probably noticed, the stockholders, so to speak, didn't object to anything the treasurer said.
Wonderful.
And no censure motions for the directors were placed before the meeting. So that I guess we've all got sympathetic people here, and we can go ahead on that basis.
I'm afraid we need them.
We need it. First, however, I want to repel the possible notion that because we're going to reminisce, either Jack or I, my very good friend, have reached our anecdotage.
Oh, upon my word.
Well, perhaps we'd better discuss first one of the two acorns from which the Institute grew, namely the senior acorn, which was part of the oak later. The Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers, in which you played so prominent a part. Will you tell us a bit about that, Jack?
Well, I can tell you something about it. I don't think I was too prominent in it. I was its secretary and was a member for a number of years. That organization, the Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers, resulted from a group of seminars among the engineering staff of the Stone Wireless Telegraph and Telephone Company up in Cambridge. They decided that it would be desirable to have a more formal organization, and so they formed, I believe, in 1907, what was probably the first professional society of radio engineers. At first, its membership was limited to the staff members of the Stone Company, but they soon grew beyond that. As a matter of fact, I have a card here which indicates that it began with 11 members of the Stone staff in January 1907. It had had a huge percentage increase by January 1908 to 17 members. You see, 6/11 is quite a growth. It had 27 members in January 1909, had 36 in January 1910, and remained static 1936 in January 11, although in January 12, just before the consolidation with the Wireless Institute, it had acquired 43 members. Now, I think that jump from 27, first to 36, and then to 43, took place when the powers that be decided that the Stone Company was not the only radio company in existence and admitted the engineers from some of the other companies, including Fessenden, for whom I worked. That was really the beginning of the thing. We'll talk later, I imagine, about how Wireless Institute got together with SWTE and how many members each contributed to the original Institute. You know more about the Wireless Institute than I do, so why don't you take over here?
Well, the Wireless Institute was really the product of the vision and energy and tact of Robert H. Marriott, the third founder of the Institute. He was a man of unusual ability, forceful, and determined, and he saw clearly in the early days of radio, around 1978, that it was very necessary to have some sort of an engineering society which would represent the members and which would substitute broad dissemination of knowledge for secrecy and concealment.
Alfred, the Wireless Institute start on the basis of taking in men from all the different organizations?
From all the organizations.
It was not a house organization to start with.
It never was.
No, I think Bob deserves an awful lot of credit for having that concept.
Yes, he foresaw something there which was basic. As a matter of fact, when the Wireless Institute started in 1909, it had 14 members. It grew in 1910 to 41, in 1911 to 99, and curiously enough dropped in 1912 to 27. That may be because the figure of a membership and that for that year was really only those who had held on in anticipation of a possible consolidation with the Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers, which, as you said at the time, had 43 members. The formation of the Institute was a curious example of a modern United Nations, of an original United Nations, rather. Each society was quite properly proud of its position and dignity and refused to be absorbed by the other. The question then was what to do about it. True, the major thing that was going to be consolidated were 50 members and about $50 in debts jointly, or $1 per member in debts. On the other hand, it was out of the question to have either proud group become a part of the other. And the solution was this. Picture before yourselves the words, the Wireless Institute and the Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers. We had to have a conjoined title. And in the discussions between Bob Marriott, Jack, and myself, we worked out this plan. In the first place, we took out wireless and substituted radio, because radio was clearly the coming thing. So now we had the Radio Institute and the Society of Radio Telegraph Engineers. We had become aware that there might in the future be something like radio telephony. So we took out telegraphy as being slightly too narrow. Now we had the Radio Institute and the Society of Radio Engineers. It was only a step to say the Institute of Radio Engineers, thus spot welding the two titles and creating the Institute of Radio Engineers. And odd as it may seem, by that small act of a high current over a small area, for instance, to produce a welding effect, the Institute was created.
Don't you think we ought to point out that there was real need of getting together? The Wireless Institute was having its difficult time in New York. The Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers was having a difficult time in Cambridge because the whole Fessenden group came down to New York, or rather to Brooklyn, and that left practically nothing of the Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers, and there was very little left of the Wireless Institute. But when we got together, we had something to start with. We had 50 members and $50 in debts, as you say. I gather from the Treasury report today that the situation somewhat changed.
It has been, shall we say, ameliorated.
A trifle.
The first president of the IRE during the last 7 months of 1912 was Robert H. Marriott. It might interest you to know who the 1913 officers of the Institute were. The president during 1913, therefore the second president, was Dr. G.W. Picard, still an active, prominent, and contributory member not only of the Institute, but of technology in our field.
You remember Picard was the man that joined for both organizations?
The only one.
Yeah, he belonged to the SWTE and to the Wireless Institute.
That's right.
That's why we only had 49 new members.
That's right.
22 and a half from each organization, or 24 and a half.
But I hasten to assure everyone he had only one vote, nevertheless. Mr. Marriott was vice president. The secretary was Emil J. Simon. The treasurer was Mr. John Hayes Hammond, Jr.
He was a safe man to trust with our treasury, wasn't he?
He seemed to be, and he has been a very safe man to trust in every respect. The editor bloomed recurrently at that time as ever, and the director...
Oh, so you didn't tell him you had been editor of the Wireless Institute's proceedings beforehand.
Yes, I had that. I had graduated. I've been graduated from editor of the Wireless Institute into the editorship of the Institute of Radio Engineers. It apparently was a life sentence from the beginning.
I think you bear up under it pretty well.
Well, I've enjoyed the job, which proves that in some ways I'm a glutton for punishment. The directors, in addition to those I just mentioned, were men well known to you all, Lloyd Espensheet, yourself, John Stone Stone, and Roy Wiegand, at that time chief engineer of the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company of America. The First time I met that grand old man of radio, Bob Marriott, was under very inauspicious circumstances, which threatened to be the last time that I met anybody. It happened this way. He had invited me to join him at the old Manhattan Beach station of his company, the United Wireless Telegraph Company. The station was located out in the swamps. You remember the location?
I certainly do. We had to go over the catwalks to get out to it, and if you didn't hold onto the railing, you'd get into the swamps rather than into the station.
That's right.
Did they ever let you into the spark gap room there? Did you ever see the spark operating?
Yes.
That was about a 40-kilowatt spark transmitter, as I remember it.
Well, you got your hearing back after a week or so. The route then to this station, through the pitch darkness of the swamp over these wooden catwalks, was an awesome, lonesome, and unpleasant one. And when I reached the door of the station, I opened it, not cautiously, just promptly, and found myself looking into the business end of the largest revolver I've ever seen, with an eager hand trembling on the trigger. It happened this way. There had been a lot of hoodlums around Manhattan Beach, and they had held up the operators to steal from them.
Steal from them what?
Well, that was a question. They weren't well paid, but perhaps they did have a few pennies at the end of the week, or else their coats could be stolen, or hats, or something of the sort.
Maybe he timed it just after payday.
The hoodlums apparently were synchronized in those days. In any case, the operators and the engineers had gotten tired of being held up and robbed, and they had decided to repel the invaders. And consequently, they had armed themselves to the teeth with this huge gun and waited at the door for some incautious hoodlum. Well, Mary was waiting there behind this gun. As I pulled the door open, his finger trembled on the trigger, and he saw me. When he recognized me, just microseconds in time, I'd say. Seemed to me like microseconds, anyhow.
Seemed like years to you, I'll bet.
He turned as pale as a sheet and told me that he actually had been about to pull the trigger. It's interesting to reflect in what celestial realm I might have been studying radio communication if he had. In any case, he didn't.
Sure, it would be celestial.
Well, I'm not so certain now, coming to think of it. That was a good station, though, Jack. You remember the operations of that station?
Yeah. Did you ever see the early audions that Doc had down there?
Yes.
He had those were the first audions that I had ever seen. He had three forms. Neither was the grid, although one did have electrostatic control. First form was what he called the U-wing. It was just a Fleming valve made with flat plates. A cathode and A anode and a B battery was the thing that Fleming didn't have. The second form he had was the same diode with a helix wrapped around the tube. And he connected that into the secondary circuit of his tuning equipment and attempted to influence the stream within the tube by the magnetic effect of the RF oscillations passing through the helix. The third one was the nearest approach to the audio, and that had a tin foil shield or an aluminum foil shield wrapped around the outside of the tube. Mm-hmm. True, it was not an interposed electrode, but it was an electrostatically controlled ionic stream, probably, rather than electronic.
As a matter of fact, that outfit down at Manhattan Beach in the late evening worked ships very systematically down off Panama. And there wasn't, of course, as much interference in those days. There weren't as many stations.
Not quite.
But nevertheless, it was hard with those old spark sets to work 1,500 miles with any degree of reliability. The operators, though, could copy through an amount of noise and atmospherics such that I venture to say that few of us here today would recognize that the signal was present at the time that these operators would get flawless copy. It's an art that I imagine is largely gone now in these days of excellent signals.
I think it has. I remember the type of men that they had, Thurston, all the rest of them. And boy, those fellows would as you say, they would write down copy when one of us with less experience would listen to the phones and hear nothing but static.
True.
Didn't Doc make, didn't DeForest Company, or United Wireless, I guess it was by that time, sell to the Navy something like four of the stations similar to the Manhattan Beach job? I think one was at Colon, one at San Juan, one at Guantanamo, Cuba, and where was the other one? Was that New Orleans?
I've forgotten.
Well, they used to intercommunicate at night. We didn't know very much about skywaves, but the boys then knew how to use them.
Yes, they had had experience enough to indicate clearly there was such a thing, and as you'll see when we come to the proceedings for the first years, there was very close consideration of that topic. We met for IRE in various places. We had first our editorial headquarters, secretarial headquarters at the College of the City of New York, and then we had headquarters down at the McGraw-Hill building for a number of years, and then finally moved up to 79th Street. And it was during that period, in the early days, of course, that the IRE symbol was adopted. Now, the meaning of the symbol, which we all take for granted, is very simple. It is, of course, nothing more than the electric and magnetic forces suitably interwoven in their normal and conventional fashion. And the theory, it was adopted on the theory that this, at least, wouldn't change, that we'd be sure of getting electric and magnetic forces through the ear, that if we took anything else, including even a highly modern device like a coherer, that might change during the years. Perhaps it was just as well that we did that and didn't stick to any particular form of apparatus of those days.
Do you remember, Alfred, that the choice of the symbol, which I think incidentally was largely due to you, that again was an instance of spot welding? The Wireless Institute had a Hertz dumbbell with WI, I believe, in the middle of it, circular.
That's right.
And the Society of Wireless Telegraph Engineers had a diamond-shaped badge, SWTE in the four corners, and a Hertz dumbbell in the middle of that. Now, the Hertz dumbbell, of course, exemplifies the static force. The Hertz circular oscillator exemplifies the magnetic force, and those two things got tied together. Well, of course, the shape of the badge could neither be circular nor rectangular because there were only three letters in the name IRE. That forced us to take a triangular form. There you have the whole story.
Interesting thing that in the 40 years since the adoption of that symbol, so far as I know, no one has ever condemned it or praised it.
Well, I've heard some praise for it, Alfred.
Well, you can go on the principle, I think, that silence is assent in this case. One of the things that was very important, which we here today wouldn't recognize, was the amount of secrecy in those days. The equipment was built back in the time the Institute was formed in such fashion that if you tried to take it apart, you found that you had to melt wax, you then melted connections or broke them, and you found that you couldn't study the circuits because the circuits had been destroyed in the mere task of trying to locate them.
There was a superheterodyne built that way much more recently.
That's right. although there were claims that that was done in order to get durability. But whatever it may have been, the real reason in the case of the superheterodyne, I will say that the real reason in the case of the early equipment used in the spark telegraph transmitting and receiving stations most certainly was to prevent anyone from discovering construction. If a man was working in radio, his closest friend was not told in what field he was working, much less the project. It was instant dismissal if you admitted the field in which you were working. And you would be astonished to know the large and influential and small and less influential companies, all of which adhered to so extreme a policy of secrecy. It reminded one of a cartoon I've seen recently in which two men are talking together on a top-secret project, and one of them says to the other, "Buster, this thing is so top-secret, we don't dare to work on it." Well, it was pretty nearly as bad as that.
Yeah, that was the original application of the classification system to radio.
That is right, and it made it very difficult to run an institute in any fashion whatever, because everyone was worried lest he might be disclosing something of interest to his competitor and thereby bring down upon his hapless head the wrath of his executive. Of course, our publication costs then as now were limited by our resources. And I may say in that connection that the cost of publishing a page of the proceedings of the IRE has mounted from a very few dollars in the beginning to almost $100 today, which gives you an indication not only of growth, but of operating cost increases during that period. The editing problems, too, were very serious. You always would need for good manuscripts, clear drawings, good discussion, and a capable printer. And we were very fortunate in getting cooperation of some people, I would say, who were zealots. They were really bigoted on the subject of making the Institute grow, and that led to the happy results of today.
I think you're going to find somewhat the same thing in the matter of the group transactions. As I think Dr. Coggeshall pointed out the proceedings has been respected, I think is really looked on as the top journal in electronics and radio. I believe you'll find that the group transactions will grow into much the same field, the same recognition, the same happy ending.
That is true, and it's an amazing thing to see to us in the editorial department how that is growing. During this month, two of the groups have published respectively 150 and 175 or more pages of editorial text in their transactions. It looks as if, in time, the total of the transactions publications might, in pages, far surpass the number of pages of the proceedings themselves, so that there is obviously a growth there that's very promising indeed. By the way, do you happen to recall that there was a suggestion made to call this the American Institute of Radio Engineers?
Yeah, I think we turned that down because we had some feeling, even in those days, that radio was going to be international, and we didn't quite like to limit the thing to the Americas.
That's true, and it was a wise thing that we did that, because some of our largest, most effective sections and loyal membership are in Canada and in the Argentine. Of course, we have many hundreds of members in other countries. As eminent an engineer as Gaino Dunn, past president of the AIE, counsel against that, although his own institute had been called the American Institute of Electrical Engineers. We had many contacts in those days with the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, and a suggestion was made several times for consolidation.
It would have been absorption. The IEEE was altogether too big, and we were altogether too little. It would have been nice in many ways. It would have saved us a lot of our early struggles if we had teamed up. But we would have had to have been I don't suppose they had sections in those days. We would have had to have been a wart or something. We couldn't get enough meeting room time. We couldn't get enough transaction or proceedings space to meet our ambitions. And so we decided against going ahead with them. I think that was wise.
It was wise. Even though we did have the friendliness of the then president of the AIE, Professor A. E. Kennelly, professor of electrical engineering at Harvard, and one of the originators of the idea of the Kennelly Heaviside layer. He himself was anxious to have this put through, and the IRE people pretty well agreed, provided we could get publication and meeting accommodation. However, it didn't work out because his own board of directors turned him down. He was so indignant about it that he became an IRE fan, so to speak, and the next year he became president of the IRE, which is a rather interesting development. There were many prominent names in the early days of the IRE, and Kennelly was one of them up at Harvard. Might be interesting for you to recall, too, that for the 3 years, 1915 to 1917, secretary of the Institute, first of an illustrious line, was a gentleman who I understand is still active in the field, namely David Sarnoff.
It's strange how many of the old crowd are still active in the field. Perhaps it isn't strange, but it certainly is true.
We are, I believe, recording this talk on tape, magnetic tape. And it's interesting that rounds out a 40-year conversation of use of tape or use of magnetic recording.
You think it's here to stay?
Well, I'm beginning to lose my fear of it now. I used it first as editor and secretary back in 1912, 40 years ago. We had the original American Pulse and Telegraphone in our offices, probably the only one in the place. You remember that?
I remember that. That was certainly the first one I ever saw. It used wire rather than tape, of course.
That's right.
But basically, it was very close to what we have today, although I don't think it worked quite as well.
No, it didn't. It worked far from as well. Although we did put in some compensating circuits and amplifiers, finally, in order to make it work better, and it gave speech that could be transcribed by a secretary without too much trouble. However, it was an all-day job to repair a break in the wire.
I don't know what you mean by without too much trouble. I think that requires a definition of too much.
I'm afraid it does. It might interest all of us here to know something of the early days of the proceedings of the IRE. The proceedings is a sort of a classical history of radio advances, and in its pages you will find substantially all the major improvements, developments, and discoveries in the art. Let's take the first issue of the proceedings, Volume 1, Part 1, January 1913. Now, the papers in that issue included one by Professor Michael I. Pupin of Columbia University, Major Armstrong's instructor, my own, I may add, on experimental tests of the radiation law of antennas. Now, at that time, you see, there was no known relationship between antenna radiation and the frequency of the radiation, so that Pupin proposed a method of measuring radiation resistance. He was a great mathematical physicist. He had developed the loading coils. He and Dr. Campbell of the telephone company developed the loading coils, which made transcontinental telephony possible for the first time. Now, Pupin mentioned that Fessenden believed that efficient radiation was possible at 40 kilocycles or less, whereas Marconi preferred 500 kilocycles. That was a subject of hot dispute, how far and down in frequency you could radiate.
I guess you remember the first edition of Fleming's book that pointed out how wet Fessenden was when he thought he could get waves off an antenna with continuous current excitation. There was no whip crack, there was no spark. Right. Yeah, that was something.
The idea of radiation at any frequency was completely foreign to even as great a man as Professor J.A. Fleming of London University at that time. Of course, that went out of the later editions.
It certainly did.
Another paper in that issue was by Lee DeForest on recent developments in the work of the Federal Telegraph Company.
Yeah, it's funny that both DeForest and Pupin got into that first issue because each of them did something for long-distance telephony.
That's true. Well, DeForest described a group of West Coast and Southern 40-kilowatt pulse and arc stations between Seattle and San Diego, reaching to El Paso and even to Chicago. Now, signaling at that time was by shift of the frequency of 100 kilocycles by about 5%. The telegraphy.
Frequency modulation.
Of a sort.
Yeah.
Of a sort. Here is the interesting thing, though. He found selective fading, and he explained it by multipath transmission. Now, that may seem rather trivial today, but if you think back four decades and try and remember that here a man found with continuous wave transmission, which was the only way to find it clearly, selective fading of that sort, you get the compensation wave or the signaling wave up, but not both, perhaps. It means that he had begun to understand the phenomena of ionospheric reflection. The paper was very capably discussed by you, I remember. That particular
I doubt it.
Well, I even went so far as to editorialize on it, and there were discussions by other eminent workers such as Lloyd Espenshee, Pupin himself, Marriott, Jay Martin, Dr. Picard, Guy Hill, and Dr. Frederick A. Colston.
We got more discussion in those days, didn't we?
Yes, everybody wanted to learn, and everybody questioned everything. There was a spirit abroad of dissent. But the engineers of those days, I will say, were extraordinarily competent and well-informed, considering the early stage of the art. Those of us who might have the impression today that these men didn't know what they were doing should revise that, because they had a clearer idea at times of what they were doing than you might expect.
I think they knew more about what there was to know, but there was a lot less to know.
That's right.
Those were the days when a radio engineer had to know practically everything that went on in radio as far as it was known, whereas today, a man can earn a living just designing grids and knowing nothing else.
You can be an expert on a certain type of transformer lamination.
That's right.
It's difficult to know.
Maybe it's not right, but it's correct.
It's difficult to know whether we ought to change the title to the Institute of Partial Radio Engineers.
I think we all qualify as associate because we're all interested in radio.
That's true. We're all interested in radio, but it's impossible today, naturally, for any man to know more than a very minor segment of the field with any degree of thoroughness. In the second issue of the Proceedings, there was a paper by R.H. Marriott himself on radio operation by steamship companies. Now, in that paper, Mr. Marriott presented a very fine group of ideals for both engineers and the IRE. And this is so important that I want to quote this with a certain degree of solemnity because it'll give you an insight into the nature, candor, honesty, and strength of Mr. Marriott. He said, "Misrepresentation concerning radio apparatus and radio companies has been, and unfortunately still is, a damper on the advancement of the radio science and art. One of the most commonly prevalent methods has been to provide an able press agent with a company-owned or controlled publication and with the privilege of inserting such statements as may suit his fancy in acquiescent newspapers. Many mysterious and hero-worshipping exaggerations have thus found their way into the press. Thus, the public has been at times woefully misinformed. Such a misleading policy is directly opposed to the spirit of the Institute. What is wanted about radio apparatus and engineers is the simple truth. Thus, the ideals of the IRE, uttered by one of its founders 40 years ago, ring clear across these 40 years.
I think it's a pretty fine job.
Oh, yes, he was...
Bob wrote well and spoke well.
Yes, he was a man whose ideas and ideals we can cherish. Then there was a paper by G.W. Pickard on engineering ethics, topic which I believe is still of interest in. Well, we sometimes wonder, and it's difficult to set forth ethics. Ethics is more a viewpoint than a detailed procedure, I believe.
You can get up a code.
Yes, but I think you have to do better than that. You have to get up a conviction. Dr. Colster presented a paper on the effects of distributed capacity of coils used in radiotelegraphic circuits. And Dr. Lewis W. Austin of the Bureau of Standards presented a paper on the relation between effective resistance and frequency in radiotelegraphic condensers. See, Pickard was already famous at that time.
That was before Austin got into the propagation end of it, wasn't it?
That is true. No, he hadn't gotten into that yet. Dr. Pickard was already famous for his work in crystal detectors and in loop receivers, and Dr. Austin was noted for his propagation measurements and laws. Now, in the third issue of the proceedings, in July 1913, there was a paper by Kennelly on the daylight effect in radio telegraphy. That was an epoch-making historical paper, and was the precursor of the general acknowledgement of the Kennelly-Heaviside layer. And that was discussed favorably by Dr. Professor Fleming in London, by yourself again. And now you presented a paper on the heterodyne receiving system and notes on the recent Arlington-Salem tests.
I was very much flattered to be in the same issue with Kennelly.
Well, you were a good man. You were, however, very learned at that time. You explained that the Greek term heteros meant other, and that dynamis meant force, and that heterodyne therefore meant the other force.
Those are the only two words of Greek I ever knew.
Well, you gave the impression of an unlimited vocabulary when you reeled that off, Jack.
Thank you.
Now, in your very clear and complete paper, you showed the inherent elements of any heterodyne reception system, my knowledge for the first time, and the mode of use of its elements, their theory, and the resulting advantageous effects. That was a historic paper.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I think we, by that time, of course, we had the rectifier heterodyne as against the old electrostatic and electromagnetic types. That gave us sensitiveness. We didn't have very good oscillators. We didn't have cube oscillators then. We used to have to use the little arcs. We got away from the noise by picking up the second harmonic of the arc and also kept the arc from burning out the detectors. But we did know the effect of linear rectification. We did know the amplification that could be had by using a large subcarrier, so to speak, a large heterodyne intensity as compared to the arriving signal and so on. So maybe it helped.
Well, we went on publishing papers standing in the December 1913 fourth issue of the proceedings. There was the Wiegand paper, Roy Wiegand of Marconi, on some recent radio sets of his company. And then came a historic moment, namely the first standardization activity of the Institute. You recall that?
I certainly do. Do you remember the preliminary report? That was 1913 also,
September 1913.
We had I don't know how many meetings of the Standards Committee, probably 40 or 50 meetings. We used to meet down on Fulton Street in White's Restaurant and Sweet's Restaurant, Sweets and White's, you know.
Yes.
And set of definitions, we felt that definitions were needed, and symbols. We thought the same symbol should be used by all the people that drew diagrams to mean the same thing. Almost any imaginative thing could be put down for a condenser in those days. Well, we got out this report, and we were scared. We thought that the membership might get angry and say that we were telling them what to do in all these matters, destroying initiative and individuality and all the rest. So if I remember correctly, we had a flyleaf, a tear-off leaf, in that preliminary report, and we asked them what they thought of it. Did anybody ever send them back?
No.
We went ahead and got out more standards reports anyhow.
Yes, we did, although we were very timid about it, and we did nothing, of course, like the present lengthy and authoritative and complex standards reports of today. Now, the first report was greeted by a deafening silence. Apparently, the membership, if it had any objections, felt it best to suppress them on the theory that perhaps standardization was good, even if they didn't think much of our standards. So But that was the beginning of a long history of standardization carried forward by the Institute. Finally, in 1914, in the volume two of the proceedings, there was a paper by DeForest on a subject of which we've heard a little since, namely, the Audion Detector and Amplifier. DeForest clearly described the triode construction and listed the factors controlling the plate circuit current, named among them, of course, the instantaneous grid potential, the amplifying relay nature of the device, which was well described, its high input impedance, and great sensitivity with stress. And incidentally, the Audion was also mentioned in this DeForest paper back there in 1914 as an amplifier for sound recording and reproduction. It was a rather early mention of that subject. Then there were several papers by Marriott, E.F.W. Alexanderson of General Electric Company on dielectric hysteresis at radio frequency, one of the great radio engineers of our century, Melville Easton, who's been so influential in the Institute on the high-tone radio telegraph transmitter, John Stone Stone on the resistance of spark and its effect on the oscillation of electrical oscillators, and a paper on radio traffic by David Sarnoff. Now, it would be very difficult to exaggerate the enthusiasm of those early workers for the Institute. They were practically conducting a crusade for better radio 365 days per year.
They still are, Alfred.
Yes, I guess all these men, those of them who are still with us, are just about as active now as they were then. When you were once inoculated with a virus of communications and electronics, apparently it was incurable. It was no wonder that the membership grew by leaps and bounds.
Where do you think we're going to go from here?
Well, it's hard to say, but we had, in January 1st, 1913, 109 members. In January 1st, 1914, 231. And in March 1914, 271, with 65 members and 206 associates. And by the way, even at that time, there were IRE members in California, Illinois, Canada, Philippine Islands, Japan, Great Britain, Germany, and even in Spanish, Honduras, Puerto Rico, and British Guiana. So that the Institute was beginning to be known in places far remote from New York, at least.
Again, showing the wisdom of leaving American out of the title.
That was right. It would have been a mistake to have limited ourselves. I think under normal conditions, with normal student growth and the like, there's no reason why, within the next decade or two, the Institute shouldn't double its present membership at least and reach something of the order of 60,000 or more members. As to its publications, I hesitate to do too much predicting there, but I will say this. In October 1951, there was published a 400-page color television issue of the proceedings, and a 720-page IRE directory, or a total of 1,120 pages in a month, which is probably some sort of a publication record for any engineering society.
Those are much bigger pages than the old one used to be, too.
Oh, yes, they're about 2.5 times as large in general. I won't go through the contents of any of those papers, because you have all seen that issue of the proceedings. Jack, I wonder if you'd like to take a jump into the wild blue yonder and give us your picture of the Institute, its groups, its sections, its student body, its aims during the next, say, 25 years or so.
Well, I think the important thing is that the Institute keep active. I'm very proud of all it has done. I'm very happy that we don't have trouble getting people to work for the Institute. Everybody seems to think it's a good idea, and as we said about the magnetic recorder, probably here to stay, like radio also. I'm not much of a prophet. I just think we ought to keep young and keep on going. And what I suggest is that here and now, you and I make a date for the 50th anniversary to do the same thing over again, provided anybody likes it.
Well, I'll be very glad to be with you that time and see whether we can look back on another 10 years of remarkable progress. We've had a number of revolutions in the Institute. First, when we went from a single section in New York to sections in great many places, including students' chapters. Then, when we went to the regions, which were consolidations, so to speak, of the sections. And most recently, when we went to the professional groups. You see, there is a vitality and youth and energy to the Institute, a willingness to change, revise, and improve, which augurs very well, I think, for the future.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Dr. Baker has mentioned the efforts of our executive secretary in keeping the headquarters going. And I think Dr. Goldsmith is convicted by his own lips of contributing to our progress all the time, year after year. I think it would be very much worthwhile, in closing the meeting, to call your attention to the fact that we have at our institute headquarters a great many other people that contribute to the efficient operation of your institute, in particular your technical editor, your technical secretary. 40th annual meeting of the Institute is now adjourned.
Jack, put it there.
One night.
Well done. Wonderful job.